Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's financial district. I am Blas Perez Enriquez, quarterly chair of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome the listeners of KAJX 91.5 FM in Aspen, Colorado, one of more than 225 stations around the country carrying America's longest running radio program. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Stephen Brill is currently the chairman and chief executive officer of Brill Media Holdings, the culmination of a 25-year career in the public eye that is remarkable in its constant challenging of conventional wisdoms. This tendency is evident throughout a wide range of professional activities, which encompass big city politics as assistant to Mayor John Lindsay of New York City in the early 1970s, and hard-hitting columns for Harper's, Esquire, and New York magazines. Mr. Brill also has a best-selling book of investigative reporting to his credit, 1978's The Teamsters. A leader in the American media, The American Lawyer, which he founded, sent shockwaves through the legal profession by publishing the salaries of big-name lawyers and dissecting the profitability of high-profile law firms. Mr. Brill expanded into new media with the spectacularly well-timed founding of Core TV, which began operations in mid-1991 and became a fixture in the national consciousness during the Menendez and O.J. Simpson years. I should mention another theme running through Mr. Brill's career up to this point, and this is his reputation for merciless fact-checking and accuracy. This rigor provoked him, in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky media frenzy of 1998, to found Brill's Content. This magazine is dedicated, in its own words, to the accuracy and accountability of all that purports to be nonfiction. The first issue contained long and detailed criticism of the coverage of the Lewinsky trial. This piece, in the words of David Firestone of the New York Times, jackhammered directly into the basement of the nation's media establishment. This provoked a predictable firestorm of hostility from the journalism community and gave rise to the tongue-twisting phenomenon of the media protesting media coverage of the media. However, with the establishment of Brill's Content and the website ContentVille, Mr. Brill has been successful in harnessing zeitgeist and giving currency to the very concept of content as a topic of national dialogue. And now, please join me in welcoming Stephen Brill.
Thank you for that long introduction. You took away part of my speech. I'm delighted to be here to speak to what I know is a group with a great tradition for dialogue and debate and for dealing with important issues. And I'd like to talk to you tonight about what I think is one of those important issues. I'd like to talk about journalism, about its changing and vital role in our democracy and our marketplace, and about what our magazine is trying to do for and about journalism, and even what you can do about it. First, let me give you an overview of my background, because it actually has a lot to do with the topic and why I feel so passionately about it. I put myself through the Yale Law School in the mid-1970s, writing magazine articles for New York Magazine, then Esquire, Harper's, and several other publications. And I, for example, I literally spent the summer between my first and second year at law school not interning at some Wall Street law firm, but writing a long piece for New York Magazine about the educational testing service, the people who with their tests, like the SAT, are the gatekeepers when it comes to getting into college, law school, graduate school, nursery school, as I have since found out, since I have children who've applied, getting into the CIA, you name it, the ETS had a gatekeeper test for it. The article was, in essence, about hidden power. Here were these powerful people at a powerful institution who affected our lives so much, yet we knew very little about them or the tests that they produce. And that article actually had a tremendous impact. In fact, someone actually came up to me tonight, 26 years later, to say something to me about that article. A year or so after writing that piece, I was standing in front of the career placement office at the Yale Law School, staring at all the letters up on the bulletin board from the big Wall Street firms, trying to recruit my classmates. Now, I wasn't interested because I already actually had a job writing magazine articles. Actually, the soda machine was in front of the placement office. But I was interested in the fact that all the letters up there on that bulletin board seemed to look the same and promised the exact same thing. Unique experience working for fabulously interesting corporate clients, wonderful training, working with people of unusual standards of integrity, with unusually high intellect. You get the picture. Dozens of letters all saying the same thing about how unusual they were. And I decided, just looking up there, staring at all those letters, that all these law firms, including many right here in San Francisco, these huge bastions of power, couldn't all be the same. These, after all, were all separate businesses, and there had to be differences among them. Some made more money than others. Some had better litigators. Some offered more equal opportunity to women, to non-whites, and to others. Some had to be more aggressive about getting new business. Some had to be more cost-effective for their clients. Some had to be nicer. Some must have been meaner. It was then that I decided to fill what I saw as another huge information gap about a powerful institution, in this case, the law, by starting a magazine called The American Lawyer, which would look, among other things, at all these law firms. Now, I won't bore you with the details, but it worked. And from that national magazine about lawyers practicing in large firms, our company expanded to include weekly and daily legal newspapers in various cities around the country, including the Recorder right here in San Francisco. Later on, I went after another information gap, the public's lack of understanding about how the legal process really works. Now, this time, the solution that I saw was a different kind of medium, the television medium. And the idea was Court TV, which used the benefits of the video medium, the ability to put someone right there to see news as it happens. My target, again, was the misunderstanding that people had about how the legal system really works, how juries really decide things. So I wanted people to see what juries see. And that worked too. Then about 2 years ago, after a disagreement with my partners at Time Warner over the direction in which to take Court TV, I sold my interest in the legal publications and in Court TV back to them and prepared for my next project. And actually, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I didn't even wait. I probably should have waited and taken some time off, but I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to do a magazine that fills what I consider to be the greatest information gap out there when it comes to the powerful forces that now govern our business lives, our political lives, and indeed our personal lives, the media, and in particular, nonfiction media. I have to tell you that I think that the magazine that we then started is the ultimate magazine for this new century. We are, after all, plunging headlong into the information age. And our premise, the premise of this magazine, is that the information age needs an independent voice that worries not about the gadgetry of the new age, not about the technology of the new age. That, to me, is yesterday's story. But worries instead about what those gadgets produce, the content. You see, as I was working on The American Lawyer and Court TV, it started to become clear to me that in terms of power and unaccountable power in this country, there is one institution that arguably has more unaccountable power than lawyers, and that's the press. Indeed, we even have a constitutional amendment that gives the press unaccountable power when it comes to the government. And that is the way it should be. The government should not be out there judging what's good media and good reporting and what's not. With that in mind, let me tell you a story about a moment when I knew I really wanted to start this magazine. It was just before the start of the O.J. Simpson trial, a little south of here. And all of us at Court TV and all the other news organizations on the planet were applying for press passes to get into the courtroom. Now, as this happened, I started hearing war stories from our people in the field that there was a little problem, which was the courtroom, I think, seated 18 or 28 people. The eight sticks in my mind, but 18 or 28 people, something like that, of which 12, 13, 15 seats, something like that, were going to be reserved for the press. And Judge Ito had several thousand applications. So what the story that I heard from one of our reporters on the scene was that Judge Ito had come up with a really good idea. And he was so concerned about all the crowding and how to deal with all these applications that he was considering an idea whereby each press entity applying for a press pass would write an essay explaining what their goals were and how they were going to cover the trial and why they were a worthy news organization to cover this trial. Well, I thought that was an absolutely terrible idea, and I called Judge Ito to tell him so. And he told me, you know, what are you worried about? I mean, you're good. You know, Court TV is a serious news organization. You have nothing to worry about. And I said, well, I am worried because no one in the government should be doing that ever. You see, I didn't want some court clerk or even some judge making value judgments saying again, you're a good reporter, you're good media, you're not good media. Now, as it turned out, the judge dropped this idea, and it ended up having some kind of lottery system and a sharing system where the National Enquirer shared a seat with the Washington Post and stuff like that. But the point of this story was that I came away thinking, well, the government shouldn't be judging media, but, you know, someone ought to take a crack at it in some way or another, or a lot of people ought to take a crack at it. Indeed, I thought that the way to raise the standards of journalism, or at least to have some standards, was with journalism, not with government. And then I started thinking about it in bigger terms. I began to think that, you know, we are, after all, living in this information age. We're being bombarded from all sides by all kinds of media, new and old, websites, 24-hour cable, docudramas, old media, new media, old media competing with new media, newsletters, talk radio, infomercials, you name it. Now, how are we supposed to know what to rely on and what not to rely on? How are we supposed to know what to believe? More broadly, how are we supposed to make sense of all the media forces that are shaping our perceptions, and indeed our kids' perceptions of everything around us, in a way that these media forces never could years ago, when all citizens were more intimately connected with the news and with the social and cultural forces that affected the world that they lived in? The simple fact is that no matter how you look at it, media or information or journalism or whatever else you want to call it, whatever else you want to call this process by which intermediaries tell us things that we can't know firsthand, ranging from the weather forecast to what car is the best car to buy or what politicians' views best reflect your views, whatever you want to call these forces, these intermediaries, that all of this work that they do is more important today than ever. Our democracy, after all, depends on people being informed. That's the underpinning of why you have a democracy, that people will know enough to make the right decisions when they vote or when they put pressure on their elected officials with letters, lobbying, you name it. Now, to take the most obvious immediate example right now, the one facing us this week, the neck-and-neck presidential race that we're watching is clearly, clearly going to be determined by the information and impressions that others, those others being the press, impart about the two candidates to the rest of us. That is the way it's going to be decided. Similarly, our free market depends on the efficient flow of accurate information so that we can all make market-efficient decisions. And our own advancement in society in this information age depends on how much good information we have access to. Yet, I submit to you that there are all kinds of forces today threatening a flow of good, reliable information. The first such force is a basic one, and it's an historic one. It's the lack of accountability that I mentioned before to any government that the press enjoys. Again, I celebrate that. We should have that. But on top of that, there are new other dynamics now in the mix. One is that the press's power is increased in proportion to the degree to which we as individuals cannot know firsthand what we need to know and what we often used to be able to know. For we live in an increasingly complex, increasingly global world where information, to take an example, about currency rates in Asia, or information about a fight over an employment discrimination law in Washington, or anything else you can think of, that kind of information really matters, yet we can't know it firsthand. We have to depend on intermediaries. To take another more interesting and current example, coming back to the presidential race, we depend on intermediaries, a lot of us, to tell us, we depend on the press to tell us after a debate who said stuff during the debate that's accurate and who hasn't. And to the extent that the press focuses on one candidate who says that he went to visit a flood site or some disaster site with someone and it turns out the guy wasn't there, to the extent the press focuses on that and says Al Gore is untruthful but doesn't focus as much because it's harder to explain or it's not as interesting or it's not as dramatic on the other candidate, Governor Bush, saying that, you know, he pushed for an HMO rights bill in Texas when he didn't, to the extent that something like that happens, we depend on the press, most of us, most voters, to tell us that kind of thing, to form our impressions. We can't usually, most of us, know that firsthand. The second new force is the movement of ownership of the basic instruments of journalism, local newspapers and television news organizations, from individual or family proprietors who wanted to make money, usually, but were also often in it for the pride and the other larger values involved. The movement of ownership of these entities from these local people to national or international publicly held corporations whose highest priority is profit and who have no personal association with the product. Now, that is not a bad thing. Profit is not a bad thing. Each of us, for example, if we're in a pension fund, each of us, when we get our quarterly reports from our pension fund and the pension fund manager says, I've maximized your shareholder value, your stock portfolio value this quarter, we think that's a good thing. Therefore, those pension funds invest in stocks that are going to go up. And they don't want to hear from a company, well, my stock's not going to rise that much because I really care about good journalism. And when you get your little report, you don't want to hear from your pension fund manager, well, this guy's really a good guy. Don't worry about the fact that your portfolio is not keeping pace with the Dow. So profit is not a bad thing. Shareholder value is not a bad thing. But it is different. It's one thing if some pamphleteer on a street corner in the 19th century is just nuts and handing out stuff that doesn't make any sense. It's one thing if some local newspaper owner in the early 20th century is an egomaniac who's fighting a grudge match. But it's quite another thing if most of the entities that bring us our news today are owned by large impersonal conglomerates whose basic corporate strategy is profit maximization, even if that means ignoring or even suppressing a story that conflicts with that goal, or even if it means producing products that a personal proprietor whose name is attached to the product would be embarrassed to have his neighbors or his kids associated with. There can be no doubt that the redistribution of so much of our media into large publicly held conglomerates is fast creating a different value system. It's not an immoral value system. It's not a value system that we otherwise don't believe in or shouldn't believe in this country, but it's a different value system. For example, I was a guest a few months back on the CNBC network, which the cable network, and I was waiting in their green room, you know, the place where you wait before you go on, and I got a little bored, so I was just sort of wandering up and down the hall, and on the bulletin board, they had a bunch of GE-like management things, like the way to measure the efficiency of preparing a news report or something like that. Now, CNBC is part of NBC, which is part of General Electric. General Electric is known for its great management. That is a different culture. That bulletin board did not have, clips from Great Scoops. It had something different. And Jack Welch, the CEO of General Electric, is revered in this country as the world's greatest manager. He is also the person who's dumbed down NBC News, or at least it's been dumbed down on his watch, who has allowed the MSNBC cable news network clearly to reach for a lower quality, lower brand of story most of the time, for example, than CNN does. And he also, on his watch, he's the CEO, has allowed his local news stations, at least the one I watch in New York all the time, to become, you know, shamelessly avid about promoting as news on local news things that simply promote some of their entertainment shows. You know, coming up next, the inside story behind, you know, some movie of the week or something, posing as news. Again, it doesn't make him a bad person. It doesn't make the people there bad people, but that culture is a different culture. It's true that corporate synergy is an overused word and it's often a myth. But when corporate synergy works on news, it can be an awful thing. I'll give you another example. It's a story that we covered in our magazine, I guess now more than a year ago, or even more than that. The ABC television network, the 2020 magazine show, was preparing a story about a pedophile problem at Disney World. Disney World, it's owned by Disney. ABC is owned by Disney. And we did a story that said unambiguously that that story got killed. Now, to me, what was most interesting about that story was that when we went to all the journalists at ABC News one by one and we named them all in this article and asked them to comment about this, none of them would comment. When we asked them, if it turned out to be true that you had killed this story, for corporate reasons, would you quit? Would you resign? No comment, no comment, no comment. And we listed all their no comments down the side of the page. What was most interesting was that after we did the story, several of these people who I estimated the people who came up to me afterwards and said off the record, gee, it was a great story, it's about time someone spoke out about it, I would turn to them and say, what about you? And these were $400,000 to $900,000 well-known news personalities at ABC. They said, I couldn't possibly do that. That's a different culture. Something different is going on. Now, ironically, ABC and Disney are now engaged in fighting another kind of corporate synergy, and that's the synergy that it fears is going to happen with the merger of AOL and Time Warner. What Disney ABC, is worried about is that this new combination is going to control not only a lot of distribution of content through the cable wires that are owned by Time Warner's cable systems, but also through AOL's internet connections. So they're worried that Time Warner's content, such as CNN or its music properties or its movie studio properties, will get an advantage in that distribution. That is a big issue. It's ironic that ABC Disney's worried about it, but it is a big issue. Now, the third new force that I think we have to be aware of is another obvious one, and that's the competitive pressure of speed and instant universal delivery that all of these increasingly profit-driven media organizations now face, the competition that stories can just burst out and happen. There's no longer a relatively sedate 24-hour news cycle, and that's because of course, of the internet. Now, the internet itself is not a bad thing or a good thing. It's a different delivery device. And I think a lot of good is coming of it, will come of it. And I think that in many respects, what we're seeing now is the beginning of a shakeout. Matt Drudge is just not the force anymore that he was 2 years ago. People ignore him because they've sort of tested out his stuff, and it can't be believed, it can't be relied on, so they just don't pay much attention to him anymore. And the analogy, I assume, is sort of like when photocopying equipment was developed and people could stand out on a street corner and hand out leaflets, the really reliable, good leafleters became the people who owned the local newspaper in town. And the ones that no one paid any attention to after a while just sort of went away. And I think a lot of that's going to happen on the internet when it comes to information that people know they need and that they know and they can judge for its accuracy. I think the best place where quality content will thrive on the internet is in areas of information more than journalism, and I refer to stock quotes. You know, if someone screws up a stock quote, you're not going to go to the internet to read those stock quotes. Weather reports, sports scores, travel information, things that clearly matter and that you go online to look for. Journalism is another question, because journalism is something often that you don't know you want to know until someone puts it in front of you. And there, what you have to worry about is that these increasingly competitive, profit-driven news organizations will, as they have in television, chase eyeballs that are attracted to news that isn't really news, but is sort of vicarious entertainment, you know, like the JonBenet story or Princess Di or something. And in the process, I think they're going to cheapen themselves and lose sight of their larger mission. So I think some news organizations, like the New York Times, are clearly not going to do that and will become places where people go for reliable information when they need absolute reliable information, and others aren't going to do it. But to me, I want to come back to this. The principal threat is the size, the synergy, and the corporate culture of what's happening in the reorganization of our media today. And the principal questions are, will important stories not get done? Will other stories be killed? To give you another example, I don't think that the current generation of Time Magazine reporters and editors would kill a story that has some great scoop about, for example, AOL's software having this terrible bug, and you know, if the story came out, it would crash the AOL price. I don't think the current generation of Time Magazine editors and reporters, some of whom I know pretty well, would kill that story. But that's not so much the question. The question is the next generation. Remember, the next generation of these people will be people who signed on to the AOL Time Warner conglomerate, not a magazine, and who have lots of stock options, and who didn't join a news organization, but rather joined a giant media organization. And that next generation, their bosses, may be people who started in some far-flung division of the company, not necessarily in the magazine writing stories. Now, will they keep to those values? We already know that in one case already, Disney, where the news president had been a corporate lawyer, not a newsman, they didn't keep to those values. So what do we do about all this? What do we do about these forces that are threatening us? Well, I think there are three kinds of solutions that have to happen at the same time. The first has to do with what I was talking about earlier when I was explaining our magazine, and that's, to put it simply, journalism about journalism. It's the combination of shame and maybe even the marketplace pressure from consumers like you, I hope, who care about quality, that can come from journalism about journalism. Put bluntly, we need more efforts like our magazine that use the press to embarrass the press and maybe even make the press behave better. Let me give you an example. We did a piece that was just sort of in a box, a short piece of a few months ago about how newspapers hold themselves accountable and make themselves accessible to their readers. And for example, we did this on some kind of a grade point, and we gave a very high grade, I remember, to the Oregonian in Portland, Oregon, which after every story has the email address of the writer who wrote the story, and on the masthead page, it tells you how to call or email the business editor and the local news editor and the sports editor and the national news editor and the culture. It tells you how to get to the people who are producing this product that you've just bought if you want to complain to them. And it has an ombudsman, and it has all these ways that you, as a consumer of this product, can make your views heard and get some action. And I noted, I was on a panel after we published this, and I noted that the Portland Oregonian had gotten a 10 or something, and I said that the New York Times had gotten a 2 or a 1. And as I was saying this, I noticed that Arthur Sulzberger Jr., who's a friend of mine, and actually still is, was in the audience. And I pointed to him. I said, you know, and Arthur Sulzberger's right here, and, you know, it's sort of unfortunate that the Times, which is such a great paper, basically you call a switchboard number at the Times and you listen to a recording and you get nothing, and you write a letter, you know, nothing happens. And I noticed Arthur taking notes as I was saying this. And about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I picked up another newspaper and noticed that a story that the Times had started to change this, that they now have opened up some kind of telephone line that is a complaint line. Now, it's not each reporter with their email address or anything like it, but it was something more than I've just described. It was a major movement in that direction. I think that's good. And I think it's the kind of thing that our magazine, by doing that story, played a role in. We got actually a lot of reactions to that from a lot of other newspapers who wanted to know more. Just as I know that we played a big role with a story we did in the Times' decision to do a major correction after the Wenho Lee debacle. So I think journalism about journalism can have an effect. We're, of course, working on a lot more, including, ultimately, we want to create a credibility index where we grade all different kinds of news entities on their credibility, and we're coming up with all different kinds of criteria for newspapers, for local television news, network news, and we're going to publish it and grade it and explain how we do it and do it every year, and we hope create something that is really meaningful. The idea is to do a bunch of things aimed at making, you know, highly principled, ethical, quality media behavior something that is rewarded in the consumer marketplace, while the opposite is punished. Now, when we started this magazine a little more than 2 years ago, most of the press, said we'd fail. They said people other than them weren't interested in all this stuff. Well, not quite. We are now ahead of our initial plan, which was to get to approximately 500,000 circulation within about 5 years. In fact, as of today, our circulation is something between 325,000 and 400,000, depending on where you stop the count. And by the first issue of next year, it'll be at 400,000. And it'll be somewhere close to 500,000, somewhere mid to the third quarter of next year. We're doing quite well. Now, I should add that in case you think the world is overrun by journalists, the way the world is indeed overrun by lawyers, that of all those people, about 25,000 of them are people who are journalists, and the rest are civilians like you. Now, that said, I know we have a lot to do with the magazine still. I wasn't satisfied with it at the beginning. We've done a lot of improving. We've broadened the scope of it. We've, I think, enhance the design and the accessibility of it, but we're in no way satisfied. When I started The American Lawyer, it took me 6 years before I really liked it as a product, and I think I'm a little ahead here, but we have a ways to go. But that doesn't mean, as I talk about improving the magazine, that we have to, that it means, it doesn't necessarily mean making it tougher or more negative. All good journalism needs to be balanced and fair. Indeed, we wouldn't want to become a magazine that's a parody of the stuff that we criticize by always going for the gotcha story. And as a practical matter, any good magazine has to be unpredictable instead of predictably positive or predictably negative. So we have a lot to do, and so far so good. I should also just mention that in our own quest to hold the media accountable the way they hold everyone else accountable, we're gaining lots of good attention for the way we're holding ourselves accountable. When we started, we appointed an ombudsman, Bill Kovach, who used to run the New York Times Washington Bureau, after which he was editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Bill is a truly legendary editor, and until recently he ran the Nieman Foundation Journalism Program at Harvard. Now, our arrangement with Bill, and now, 2 years later, our arrangement with his successor, Michael Gartner, who's a former Wall Street Journal editor and president of NBC News, our arrangement with them is simple. The ombudsman has a no-cut contract for 2 years. We can't fire him. He can't be rehired, so he can't, you know, try to suck up to us so we rehire him, which is why we don't have Kovach anymore. When someone complains about anything in our magazine, by letter, by call, or anything, I investigate it, and I hope handle it diligently and candidly. But Bill, or now Michael, also gets that same complaint and investigates it wholly on a separate track. In every issue, he can write whatever he wants about any complaint that he wants to write about at whatever length he chooses. That's the contract. And whatever he writes is printed in a front section of our magazine. Now, that's our way of putting our principles of accountability on the line, and readers really appreciate it. Also makes for some very good reading once in a while. Which brings me to the second prong, if you will, of what I think we need to do when it comes to protecting our media and journalism in this new age. I think we need the kind of voluntary guidelines, frankly, that our magazine has adopted for corrections and accountability to spread to every other publication. I don't know for my life why any self-respecting news organization wouldn't have the kind of ombudsman we have. Not someone, as some newspapers have, who's a reporter for the newspaper and they assign him or her a year to work on reader complaints, and then a year later he goes back into the newsroom with his colleagues and he's an employee of the company. I mean, that's not what I'm talking about, someone who's wholly independent and wholly fearless. Now, our magazine, or maybe me with speeches like this, can shame others to do it, but ultimately they have to make the right decision. And I'd like to suggest today that most journalists, that those journalists and those executives at leading journalism companies that really care about their profession and about its role in our democracy can move this and should move this beyond an ad hoc notion as follows. They should start a real journalism organization that has real standards, that has real guidelines, basic principles that everyone has to agree to follow in order to be part of this organization, like separating, you know, advertising considerations from editorial considerations, making candid prompt corrections, having an independent ombudsman, basic standards. You and I could probably figure this out. You know, we could list the first five right here. Have basic standards and have a complaint and a disciplinary process. And that means that they'd kick people out who violate those standards. They'd let people in. They'd not let people in. They'd make being a member of this organization a badge of quality. Now, at least lawyers have standards. Whether they enforce them or not is another question. It's always been a big question in California. But they have a code. They have something that at least they say they enforce. Journalists don't even have that. Now, when I suggested guidelines in just one narrow area relating to, I mean, one article I did, relating to when and how news organizations would take pictures of children, they laughed at me. So we don't want to have guidelines. We want to make our own decisions. We don't think we need guidelines. We think the public trusts us not to invade people's privacy. This was an article I wrote after the death of John Kennedy Jr., where we all were treated to pictures of, you know, with cameras that had peered through the hedges of Caroline Kennedy's backyard out on Long Island, taking pictures of her minor kids. We make every decision on a case-by-case basis with the highest standards of respect for privacy and fairness. We would never agree to general guidelines. Now, that reaction to me was emblematic of the arrogance and the unreal, insular world that most people in the media live in. They don't understand that most of the rest of us don't trust them just to govern themselves on an ad hoc basis. They don't understand it. Just the way I'd go to bar association conventions all the time, and there's always be a debate about letting members of the public in on the lawyer disciplinary process, and lawyers would say, I don't understand. Why doesn't the public trust us to have secret meetings and decide what lawyers to do? Don't they know that we all have the highest possible standards? The answer is a lot of people don't know that because some lawyers don't have those standards. Maybe most do, but some don't. Now, you all can help in this process. If you think about it, you should complain more, send more letters, applaud publications like the Oregonian in Portland that have an accessibility system and an accountability system. Ask your publications if they don't, why they don't. Condition advertising on publications having certain standards. There's nothing wrong with that. You are consumers of all this stuff, and consumers need to act like they care and act like they're in charge. As I said before, we need to try to make this a marketplace that works, and one of the ways marketplaces work is that quality gets rewarded. Standards get rewarded. Now, I also promised you a third prong beyond the first two, the first one of journalism about journalism, and the second one of these kinds of guidelines and a disciplinary process. And here's the third prong, government. Now, I'm not talking about governing content, but I am talking about the government getting involved in non-content process and structure issues. Indeed, some of you may be surprised to know that the government is already involved. The government gives lower postal rates to magazines that can establish that they're magazines by saying we have X percentage of editorial content as compared to advertising. They get lower postal rates when they mail their magazines. The government gives FCC licenses to people based on certain alleged standards. The government is an antitrust regulator. The government does get involved. Now, let's start with the last thing I mentioned first, antitrust regulation. Antitrust regulation, traditionally as we know it, is about competition. And the basic standard, to oversimplify it, is that if there are three widget companies and they all get together to become one widget company, the antitrust regulators will say, well, that's a bad thing because now there's only one widget company. But if there are three and they compete with each other to keep the price down, that's okay. So the standard is, are there enough competition to keep prices down and to encourage innovation? I submit to you that that's fine for widgets, but it's not fine for ideas. It's not fine for free expression. And what I'm proposing to you tonight is a different way to think about expression and ideas in journalism when it comes to antitrust law. I think the antitrust law should be amended to require the FTC and the Justice Department, when they're asked to approve a merger, not to approve a merger if such a merger would threaten the diversity of ideas and expression in the marketplace any more than it is now already being threatened. Specifically, I'd change what's called the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act to set up a whole new review process for all media mergers from this day forward involving asset sales of more than, say, $250 million, which is not a terribly radical idea since the current sort of overall review process, I think, involves deals of $15 million. I'd make this a real review process with standards and hurdles that these companies that want to merge at that size have to get over. In addition, I think the antitrust law should be enforced in a way that begins now to separate content from distribution. Remember what I was saying about AOL Time Warner having all these distribution channels and Disney worried about whether its stuff will be carried on those channels. In 1948, the government forced the movie studios to sell off all their theater chains. We need to think about that again, separating content from distribution. We should stop any such mergers now that involve joining content with distribution, and we should give corporations above a certain size that now have that kind of synergy 5 years or so to divest either the content assets or the distribution assets. Second, government subsidies, postal rates, things like that. I think it would be perfectly constitutional and perfectly okay to condition postal rate support on certain standards that organizations would have to have in terms of how accountable they hold themselves. Not necessarily anything having to do with their content, but what their process is for example, taking complaints. Or if that's too murky and involves all kinds of definitions that are hard to get to, at least one thing we could do with postal rates with publications is change them according to the size of the corporation. Give smaller entities that want to start publications a break over larger ones. And that would at least encourage the kind of diversity that I think we want to encourage. Now, we do have a little more leverage when it comes to FCC licenses, and I think there's one thing we could do. Well, actually, there are two things. We could require of news organizations that have FCC licenses the kind of ombudsman and complaint process as a criteria that the FCC would use in judging whether a license would be renewed. But the second thing we could do would be a simple rule. And, in fact, there is sort of this rule when it comes to postal regulations now. I believe deeply in the power of embarrassment. Notice when I talked about NBC and sleazy old MSNBC, I said Jack Welch. I believe deeply in the power of embarrassment. And you have all these very large media companies with CEOs who are very respectable, decent people, who are on the boards of every local charity, and who are honored, as they should be, for all the work they've done, who are producing or whose companies produce a lot of really lousy, sleazy stuff. If, for example, at the end of the Jerry Springer show, in a city where the Washington Post Company owns that television station, the very last credit line in a certain size type should be the Jerry Springer show brought to you by Katharine Graham or Donald Graham. Whoever the chief executive is of the company that is responsible for that program ought to have his or her name attached to the program. It's not governing content. You're not saying you can't do it, but at least make it something that people feel. I think that there is really something to be said for people feeling personally accountable for the stuff they do, and this is one simple way to do it. Now, as for us at our magazine, we're going to try to keep doing what we've been doing and play what I hope is a vital role in these kinds of issues. Now, we don't mean to be and aren't quite just the rabid watchdog that the rest of the press makes us out to be. We're a magazine that has all kinds of service pieces, that has profiles, that has all kinds of stuff that's just plain interesting about media. Yet, of course, we keep being called only a media watchdog. Now that, I submit to you, is like calling the local newspaper a civic watchdog. That's part of what the local newspaper is supposed to do, but it's not all they do. And I think the fact that the press keeps calling us a, quote, media watchdog is, to be blunt, emblematic of their shock that anyone is watching them at all. It reminds me that, you know, lawyers incessantly called the American lawyer in the first 10 years we existed a legal watchdog and a scandal sheet, when all we did was report on the business of law firms, good, bad, and different. That's what we did. We did journalism. When people aren't used to having journalism happen to them, they tend to call it watchdog. And that's not bad, but it's not really all that we do. But, of course, we do hope to play an important role, and I hope become one of what may ultimately be many standard setters for quality in this very important area. And as many of you know, we're also engaged in expanding our franchise with efforts such as contentville.com, which sells all different kinds of content, books, magazine subscriptions, archives, research material online, with a lot of independent experts telling people what they can believe about this stuff and what they can't believe. And I think the tone and ethos of Contentville matches perfectly what our magazine does. Now, we expect to make lots of mistakes along the way, and we expect that the rest of the press isn't going to be shy about telling the world about those mistakes. Indeed, we never expected to build this enterprise on the kindness of those that we're writing about. But ultimately, and in some quarters even now, we will be seen, I think, as the best thing that ever happened to good, accountable journalism. And indeed, to the majority of journalists who, I think, chose that profession because they share exactly those same values. Thank you very much for listening to me tonight.
Thank you, Stephen Brill, founder and editor-in-chief of the magazine Brill's Content. And now, to conduct the question and answer portion of our program, here's Skip Rhodes, president of the club.
Thank you, Blas Perez Arrique, our chair for today. Mr. Brill, if you'd return, we've got a lot of questions. We'll try to get as many as we can in the remaining time. The first one. In light of the ongoing discussions of left or right bias in reporting, could you please comment on the practice of the editorial boards of, quote, objective, unquote, newspapers recommending particular politicians for election?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it at all. Although we actually were having this discussion the other day, and one of our smartest senior editors suggested that we do a story just like that, because she said it sort of freaks her out that, you know, no one ever questions how newspaper editorials can endorse candidates when, and what she was saying really is that that people don't understand the separation between the editorial board and the journalist. Now, ironically, this editor of ours used to work at the Wall Street Journal, so she understands it because the Wall Street Journal has this, you know, fanatic right wing, you know, editorial stance, and the reporters, if anything, lean the other way. I think it's traditional. I don't think there's anything really wrong with it as long as it doesn't seep into the news coverage.
Do you see the advent of internet journalism as having a positive or negative effect on accuracy and fact-checking?
Yes. What I mean by that is, you know, it's like asking, do I see the advent of you know, Gutenberg as having a positive or negative effect on the spread of you know, great ideas? Some people are going to use the internet to do really lousy, rotten stuff, and others will use it to do really terrific stuff, and it's the marketplace of ideas at work, and I think ultimately that marketplace works, and there's no alternative to that I can think of, because I don't want to have anyone in some government office deciding that something's better than something else.
Several questions here on the election. Didn't 4.5 hours of debate between Gore and Bush give the public a reasonably unfiltered view of the candidates?
Well, I think it would have been more vivid and more helpful if the moderator had done a better job. I think that Jim Lehrer took his neutrality a little too seriously and became the potted plant in the Oliver North testimony. I think the role of a moderator really in that case ought to be, in terms of both candidates, to question them on statements that they make, if there's a gap between what they've said and what the facts are, or at least to push the debate in that direction. And there are a lot of people who disagree with me about that. But I also think that that problem could have been in some way corrected if the press particularly the television press, which is where, sad to say, most people get their information, had been a little better about doing their own work right after the debate to find the really substantive mistakes or misstatements that people were making.
Given part of your answer to that last question, I thought I'd move this question up to the next one. And it is, this is a question about public television. NewsHour moderator Jim Lehrer often seems more interested in ingratiating himself in high places to the neglect of exploring certain sensitive issues. Will your magazine discuss that behavior in a forthcoming issue?
Well, we may do something about Jim Lehrer, but I think that question, I think that characterization is completely unfair. He is a really terrific journalist. I was referring to a disagreement I have with his method of being a moderator, but he's a tough guy, and I just don't agree that he conducts interviews that way. He's interviewed me on the NewsHour, and I certainly never felt it was like that. I think he is not one of those interviewers who thinks that the test of a good interview is how long he gets to talk. But I just don't think that's fair. Whether we're going to write something about Jim Lehrer, of course we will in some way or another.
After much media pontification about the need to focus on issues, this presidential election seems to be about personality. How much is the media to blame for this?
Well, I'd love to say a lot, but I'm not so sure how much. And also, I have this strange thought that I was thinking on the plane coming out here. I'm not sure issues in some way are overrated as campaign fodder. And what I mean by that is I remember as a 10-year-old knowing everything about knowing everything about Richard Nixon and John Kennedy's policies with regard to Kamoi and Matsu. And, this debate over this issue, as I recall, it was some little island off of Taiwan or something, and who was going to protect it and what were we going to do. Most of the issues, if you think about them, that were the center of recent presidential campaigns didn't play out in policy one way or the other based on who got elected once the election was decided. And that's because no matter what Governor Bush or Vice President Gore say about, tax policy, for example, Congress is going to have something to say about it. They're going to change their minds when someone briefs them on the budget. What was the big issue in when President Clinton ran in 1992? It was how President Bush had coddled the Red Chinese coddled these people, and he was going to be tough on them because they were, because of their human rights policy. Where did that go? What happened there? I mean, and the converse, I think, is really true. I think that the personalities of and the abilities of the candidates really count a lot. I think it is very significant that Al Gore's campaign has been disorganized, that he's had staff trouble, that he's had this rotation of people. He doesn't seem to be in control of his staff or his agenda, that the message changes. I think that casts some real doubt on how competent a presidency he'd have. Because, after all, the only thing that a presidential candidate runs when he's running for president is his campaign. Once he's in the White House, he runs the country. And one mirror on how he might be an executive and a leader and someone who harnesses people to go in his direction is how he runs his campaign.
Mr. Brill, this question is being asked from a reporter, and he or she says, as a journalist, which publications and other news sources do you turn to for reliable information? Any must-reads in your daily news diet?
Well, once again, I'm a little bit strange about that. I get up early in the morning, and I have delivered to my door The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, the New York Post, which I read for fun, the New York Daily News. I will usually look at the LA Times when I get to the office. I'll log on to, I'll look at Slate, I'll look at Salon. What else do I do? Television, I don't get much news from television. I'll look, sometimes during the day I'll look at, you know, CNN Interactive, or I'll look at MSNBC, just see what's going on, or if we're still all alive and here. But I don't, and then magazines, I mean, you don't want to know. I mean, I read dozens of magazines, but you could, guess you could kind of say I get paid to do that, so I should do it, you know.
What is your opinion of the public's widespread acceptance of historical dramas, particularly those of Oliver Stone, as gospel fact, in spite of the fact that Mr. Stone denies this is his intention? To what extent should he be held responsible?
Oh, I think I could just stay here for another 2 hours on this. It makes me crazy that a lot of teenagers in this country, think they know all about the Kennedy assassination because they saw JFK, and it is such a perversion of what our values ought to be. And it's so hypocritical because what they do, like the movie Hurricane, which is, when it comes to facts, total garbage. That movie, which they advertise as based on a true story, and they have the real Hurricane Carter as a prop and everything, based on a true story. Then when Oliver Stone is called to task on this, he says, well, no, this is a movie. Will you stop getting upset about this? It's just a movie. Well, they use the prop of a true story to sell it. I mean, it wouldn't be interesting if someone said, listen, I have this movie about a fighter and he got convicted of something and he came back and he was wrongly accused. You know, unfortunately, some black guy in Newark who gets wrongly accused and put in jail is not like a top-of-the-charts story. A story about a famous boxer who gets wrongly accused and gets sprung, that's the plot line. That's a story. That'll generate attention. That's what gets Oliver Stone on more television shows than if it's not. So they use the, quote, authenticity to sell it, and then they run from it as fast as they can, and people really get sucked into it, really, really get sucked into it. There's that one. The Hurricane Carter one bothers me because I wrote something about it in my prior life, and I know a lot about it. Obviously, the O.J. Simpson thing, I mean, all this stuff, it's the rankest, worst kind of stuff, because instead of just being entertainment, it's just deceptive. It's propaganda.
Do you see a way to get the media out of the private lives of public figures? Or do public figures give up their rights to privacy and all aspects of their lives are fair game?
Well, one way to get the media out of the private lives of people, including public people, is for their customers not to buy the stuff or watch it. You know, there is a sort of rubbernecking at car accident aspect to a lot of this stuff. We all know we shouldn't rubberneck at a car accident because it's really not the thing to do. It's kind of, exploitive, causes traffic behind us. When we're behind and watching other people rubberneck, we say, my God, how can they do that? These people, why don't they just drive? It's delaying me. And then as soon as we come up to the accident, we look at the thing ourselves. And there's a lot of that in the media. I think that, we're, to some extent, we're never going to stop it. But again, if you embarrass people about it, embarrass the people who make the decisions, you can do it. And the other thing you can do is not have lowest common denominator journalism. I wrote this little piece in the magazine a while back about how the New York Post had done this completely ridiculous, trashy, sourceless story about Chelsea Clinton having some emotional problem at Stanford or something, and it was worse than that. Friends say that it was completely baseless. It was in the New York Post. It gets picked up out of the New York Post, goes on to the AP wire as the New York Post is reporting that. Therefore, the AP is protected. And I'm not talking about legally protected, but protected sort of journalistically because they're saying we're simply reporting the fact that the New York Post reports this. So that's accurate, right? The New York Post did report it. It comes off the AP wire and makes its way into the Boston Globe, owned by the New York Times. And I write a story saying this is very interesting. You know, the New York Times company has just allowed Rupert Murdoch to become its editor because the New York Times would never do that story, but because it was in the New York Post, it becomes something that ricochets around, you know, the media echo chamber and goes everywhere. That is something that is really awful.
Unfortunately, we've come to that portion of our program where we have time for one last question. And that question is, what do you think about the idea that the American public is simply getting the media it deserves?
Well, it is a free market, and you know, that's not entirely bad. There is a lot. When people ask me, no one asks me this question, but it's the basic general question I get asked, which is, do you think the media is doing a good job or a bad job, you know, as if anyone could answer that question. And I always answer yes, because the fact is there is more good stuff out there today, both on cable television and on the internet and in print. There is more good stuff out there today than ever, and there is more really crappy stuff out there than ever. And yes, the public is getting what it deserves, and those who want to watch and look at and read the really bad stuff can do that. And those who want to look at the good stuff can do that. The issue, though, is what's different is that the common experiences we all had as citizens in the 60s, let's say, of, you know, three, you know, monopoly broadcast networks that brought us the news, and we all sat around and watched it together and shared this experience, and it sort of united us as citizens. That's gone. But then again, who wants to vote for having three monopoly networks with, you know, three white guys doing the news for a half hour telling the rest of America what to think? You know, it's a trade-off. Thank you very much for having me.
Our thanks to Stephen Brill, founder and editor-in-chief of the magazine Brill's Content, and our thanks to all of you. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.